This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
And we're back, folks. Thanks for hanging with us. Still having a few technical difficulties here, but we continue to try and work through it. Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana, joins us as he does every Thursday morning at 11 a.m., and we appreciate saying, Doc, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Neil. Good morning. It's nice to be back with you.
So, Doc, where do we stand this week as we did last week? We're moving further and further away from the Labor Day weekend, and what are the numbers revealing?
We continue to look good, which is good news, although I still feel the same that I did last week, which is tenuous, because I know, you know, there's just more activity out there now. There's schools back, there's some football, you know, bars are going to open up soon. So I still feel tenuous, but I'm happy the numbers continue to go in the right direction. Just to illustrate it a little bit, percent positivity in Orleans Parish specifically has been declining fairly steadily. It's at 1.5% now. That's the smallest it's been since we had, you know, since this really started. Jefferson Parish has gone down. Jefferson Parish is now at 3.7%. That's the smallest it's been. Plaquemines and St. Bernard are also below 5. So those are really encouraging numbers. It's evidence of just the hard work that I think people are doing and, you know, doing what's right, distancing and masking. That said, you know, we do have just, you know, every day there's something new. There's more activities. One more school is back in session, or people gathering for a Saints game, and that's going to continue. So the risk is real. It's likely increasing by the day. So there's every reason to, you know, continue to be as vigilant as we have been.
Is part of your concern because of what's going on overseas? We touched on that a little bit last week. Is that what's kind of driving when you use the word tenuous?
Yeah, that's part of it. And, you know, to recap what's going on, some countries like Spain, for example, that had very serious outbreaks not too far along from when we had ours here back in March and April, a lot of casualties there, and then implemented very stringent measures, you know, lockdowns much more stringent than we had here, and were doing well for a few months, are seeing outbreaks now again. And, you know, that argues a couple things. It argues how tenacious this virus is. And really, the second that you let up, you see cases come back. It also argues against this notion that if you had a spike, you somehow have enough herd immunity to prevent from future spikes. That's a myth that's been floating around that is not backed up by real evidence. I mean, we, you know, epidemiologists, this is what they do, it's what they study, and they'll tell you, you really need 60-70% of exposure in a community to have enough herd immunity to protect, you know, against further spread in this setting, and nowhere in the U.S. has that. So, you know, you also look at some other states, there's now spikes going through parts of the Midwest. And some of this is predictable. You know, there was the Sturgis motorcycle rally in South Dakota. That was, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago, something like that. And now both Dakotas are having, you know, what looks to be the worst outbreak in the country right now. So this stuff is predictable. And, you know, we've got a lot of time here between now and when a vaccine is going to be available in mass quantity for the general public. A lot of time to potentially have another spike that we're going to have to work really hard to prevent.
Yeah, you know, I guess what's a little bit frustrating, too, for you guys, I know it is for me, is some of the guidance that came out of the CDC last week, that a preliminary report was actually put out, and then they pulled it back, and as it relates to the size of the particles and exposure and transmission and so forth.
Yeah, that was nonsense. It's not really questioned right now amongst serious scientists that there is plenty of evidence that this virus can spread through aerosolized droplets. And, you know, the 6 feet distance, that's an average. That's, you know, you got to put a number to it so people can be reasonable with their actions. And that's the best guess, you know, but it's not an absolute. And there's been plenty of instances documented when people are doing higher risk activities, particularly indoors, that the virus can spread beyond 6 feet. A great example of that is singing or choir. And there's a really well-documented case just north of Seattle from earlier on in the outbreak where there was a choir practice. One person was infected, and at the peak of their viremia, you know, it's the most infectious they would be, happened to be at that point in time, and they infected, I can't remember the number, but something like 30 or 40 other people inside that choir practice. Obviously, they weren't all within 6 feet. So the evidence is there, and it's frustrating to see these institutions that, you know, not only are world renowned, but, I mean, to me, the CDC, you know, heroes. I mean, they're the best in the business, kind of suffer these political oscillations. I hope you get past that, really.
You know, and I'm glad that you said that the 6 foot distance is an average. It's really a compromise at some point in time, because if you went too much further as it related to separation, let's just pick a number and say 18 feet. Well, it would almost be literally impossible to function as a society if we were compelled to separate at that distance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just not practical. And that's, you know, public health is really the intersection of medicine, health, politics, and practicality. And you got to try and distill the data and make a recommendation that not only makes good scientific sense, but is something that's actionable. And, you know, just like you say, you can't tell people keep 20-foot distance because it's not practical. So 6 feet is a good compromise. And in almost every scenario, it really does offer a great level of protection. But there are high-risk activities that go beyond that, like singing, like blowing a wind instrument. And as data comes in, we have a better understanding of these type of things, and we try and communicate it. You know, that frustrates people. I'll tell you, people in K-12 schools are really frustrated now that we continue to advise against indoor choir practice or playing wind instruments indoors. But this is why we advise against it, because the data to this point shows that it's a higher risk activity than other things are.
And not to pick on your words, but when you say the data at this point, I think a lot of folks, in fact, I just had a caller earlier call about this, and it's why I've been reluctant to really criticize our leaders much, because data at this point is a critical terminology. Because a lot of this, it's not a guess. It's an educated guess or an estimate, as we just talked about. And you try to adopt procedures to weave into, you know, society and government and other, you know, from an operational sense that has some semblance of common sense, but that's not always achievable.
Yeah. Yeah, you do the best you can. And you have to allow for some nuance in that. And one of those pieces of nuance is, as new data points come in, as more experience is gained, sometimes the recommendations change. You know, we understand this in other areas of life. You know, when there's a storm just entering the Gulf, you know, the meteorologists takes the data points and makes the best prediction they can about where that thing's going to go. And that prediction gets more accurate as time goes on. And that's what we feel the scientific community is doing with COVID. It's continuously reevaluating the data, incorporating new data, revising guidelines as they become, indicated to be updated. And in such a new virus, that's just by nature going to be a fluid process.
Right. We got to get to a break. 504-260-1870. We have Dr. Joe Cantor, the Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Newell on WWL.
All right. We're back with Dr. Joe Cantor, and all of the technology is up and running now. So we are excited. Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana. We've had a little glitch there, Doc. Been doing this by the telephone as opposed to our other equipment. But so, Doc, when on the text line, a number of people are asking on the website, it says probable cases. They'd like to know what that means.
I wonder if they're referring to probable deaths, which I think is what they're referring to. And what that is there are instances where the coroner investigates a death that more than likely was due to COVID because, for example, it was, let's say, a nursing home resident who died of a respiratory complication in the context of a larger outbreak of COVID in that nursing home, for example, or something similar to that. And for one reason or another, they weren't able to get a COVID test on that individual either while they were still alive or posthumously. They can catalog that death as a probable COVID. And that's how we count it. We don't lump it in automatically with the confirmed COVID deaths, but we do display it. I think it totals something like 182 right now.
Actually, this number is 1,224. So I'm curious if that is something that's tied to confirmed cases as opposed to confirmed deaths. Because on the dashboard, it has presumed recovered, and then next to that, it says probable cases, 1,224. So that's probably a different number. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a new addition. I think I'm going to have to get back to you next week on that, Noel.
Yeah.
I'll get an answer.
That is new. It hasn't been here. I think this may be the second week that it's there. I've noticed a couple of modifications. A lot of great data, quite frankly. Very transparent as it relates to that and trying to explain some of these numbers. Doc, you and I have talked about this before, but I wanted to revisit it because I've read at least three, if not four, possibly five articles being very critical of these clinical trials because they have not tested children. And but that, based on what you said before, that's not unusual. They're usually the last to be tested as we're kind of rolling out vaccines, correct?
We're talking about vaccine trials, right?
Vaccine trials, yes.
Yeah, it's very challenging to enroll children in these types of trials, but they're going to have to. Without a doubt, they're going to have to because we're going to have some data, just like we are on all types of different population subgroups. Now, there's still some time for that because we're still a number of months away from, when a vaccine is likely going to be available to the general public, including healthy kids. The first couple rounds are going to be for first responders, healthcare workers, people with real serious conditions. There is still some time, but they are going to have data. You cannot push a vaccine to large numbers of healthy kids without having data that it is both effective and safe. Now, there's three platforms that vaccines are being developed upon, the kind of three models, if you will. One, which is the one that has entered phase three trials most recently, is based on mRNA, which is essentially genetic material. And that's the one that's most progressed. There's a couple of those in phase three trials, and that's probably going to come out first. Now, further away in the pipeline are vaccines basically called vectored vaccine, or basically a live attenuated virus. And then the third type is what's called a subgroup vaccine, and that's the one that's most similar to common vaccines like hepatitis A, hepatitis B, and so forth. The benefit of those is that it's a little particle protein of the COVID virus that's joined with a base, if you will, and that base is a very similar base to what's used in vaccines currently. So with something like that, we know that that's safe because all the data exists. But you're absolutely right. They're going to have to show that it's safe in kids before they recommend it that's being given out.
Interestingly, when you talk about these three platforms, there's also a series of articles that have come out that to say that first to market may not be the best one.
Yeah.
And it very well may be the last one that's actually being done by pharmaceutical companies that have actually developed vaccines before and have a clearer understanding, knowledge set, and everything else of what they what the ultimate end game is going to be for that vaccine.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, best is a general term. You can conceivably think that we might have one vaccine that has a better safety profile but is less efficacious at preventing infections, and one, you know, that's better at preventing infections but has a worse safety profile. So those are going to be, you know, tough decisions. I want to circle back for a second, Newell, because I did get the answer to the probable cases. So, and this is what I thought, I just didn't want to say it before I was sure. Now that we have antigen testing available, which is a new testing platform, it's a rapid platform. A number of these platforms have been given out to nursing homes now. They're being used in a couple other settings of the state, and they're going to increase. When you test positive on an antigen platform, it's a presumptive positive, and it needs to be confirmed by a PCR, by a traditional test. And so that's what that probable case number is. It's people that tested positive on antigen and are waiting for confirmation with a formal test.
Yeah, it right away when I saw the number, I didn't think it had anything to do with deaths because it was far too large of a number for sure. As it relates to kids as well, they're staying in that sphere. They've had some recent statistics revealed as to this positivity rate of children after having been back in school. And I don't know if you saw or read about this. I know a number of the news agencies were reporting on it last evening that seemed to be very encouraging. The same with teachers. You know, that the positivity rates seem to have not been what a lot of people expected.
It is encouraging. We've not seen mass outbreaks that some people feared with the resumption of in-person learning for K through 12. We certainly have seen cases, and they're beginning to be reported on the LDH dashboard. There's a tab on the left-hand side called COVID outbreaks, and then it's got a bunch of settings, and below that it'll tell you K through 12 and higher education. So we certainly see cases, and students are having to quarantine because of that. But we've not seen a lot of secondary transmission. You know, I mean, not seen a lot of virus being spread from person to person inside a school, and that's reassuring. It doesn't mean that we won't, but I think that schools know the value of distancing. They've put a lot of effort into spacing out the desks, controlling ingress and egress for entry and exit of school and lunchtime and stuff, and encouraging masking when the kids are old enough. So those are really reassuring numbers, and I think it's to the credit of educators and the hard work that they put in. And this hasn't been an easy thing for them to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you put the protocols in, you rely on human conduct, you either practice what the the procedures that are set out, or you don't, and it seems as though that's a pretty, as you point out, a pretty decent indication that they're actually following the guidance.
Yeah, yeah, and that the mitigation efforts work. You know, we hosted a visit from Dr. Deborah Birx of the White House Coronavirus Task Force yesterday. And she's been on a college tour, really, of SEC campuses, and she wanted to talk about college settings. And we had a meeting with a bunch of officials from LSU, some other universities, and the governor. And she made two really salient points that I wanted to share with folks. The first is she really hampered down on the notion that mitigation works. And she countered this myth that you can just let the virus rip and it's going to go away on its own. She said, this virus does not go away except when it is actively mitigated. She said that a number of times. And she credited Louisiana, you know, for the work that was being done. The other thing she said that I thought was interesting to her to say is she kind of took LSU to task for not doing more testing on the Baton Rouge campus. And she said, listen, when you don't do widespread testing in a setting like that, I mean, you might see a short-term benefit because your numbers are going to be lower, but it will catch up with you and it will lead to more disruption in education down the road because you just can't hide from this virus. So she really encouraged more testing as a way, you know, you'll have short-term interruptions, but you'll save the real long-term interruptions or the larger interruptions.
And I guess that's especially true when you have so many asymptomatic cases that you're better able to have your finger on the pulse of what's actually going on in any respective community or micro community, such as a university campus, right?
Yeah, and you know, we're talking right now up to 60% of cases are asymptomatic at the time that they're tested. So that's a huge number, and it's silent spread. There's no way to know until you do testing. And in a college setting, you know, doing what we call population-based surveillance testing, where basically you test everyone, or she wanted to see 10% of a college campus being tested every week, which is ambitious. That's, you know, close to what Tulane is trying to do. And she said that's the best way to control it. And you do that, you quarantine appropriately, and at the end of the day, you're able to keep people on campus. You're able to preserve the institution by doing that. Now, as it relates to K through 12, you know, we're not doing that type of testing in K through 12, but there's still community testing available. And, you know, I've heard these anecdotes mostly from outside of the New Orleans area, to be clear, but of families with kids in school not wanting to get tested or being afraid of the result or really being averse to getting tested. And I think that's pretty dangerous because this virus spreads silently and knowledge is power in that sense. You can't control it unless you have visibility on it.
Yeah, I mean, we've had this conversation in our own family about this COVID shaming almost that goes on sometimes where, you know, allegedly there's HIPAA out there, but, you know, you've got office buildings notifying, well, someone on elevator shaft 3 at 1208 went up the elevator and they were COVID positive, and everybody's trying to figure out whether or not they were on that elevator, which one is elevator 3, and, you know, on and on and on. And as you kind of drill down on a series of concentric circles trying to figure out who actually was that person, you have almost as many people spending time trying to figure that out as opposed to just wearing the freaking mask. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's a tough one because you try and strike a balance between protecting people's, you know, identity and their health information, and this is a health issue, versus, you know, when you do work in an office building or a shared setting, you have to do due diligence to make sure that people that were potentially exposed know it so that they can quarantine. You know, when we talk to businesses with these types of issues, we counsel them that, you know, really only release as much information as is needed to allow people to do that. But there's no black and white on this. It's tough. You're absolutely right. So sometimes more information gets released than is needed, or even when you don't release more information, it causes a lot of stir and some shaming, and that's not great.
Where are we on our test results? Read some articles in some states, and some states are actually retreating off of testing because they can't seem to get their results in a timely fashion, and they're still struggling with 7-day turnarounds, and they're saying this is of no little or no value to us at this point.
Doing a lot better than we were previously. So almost consistently now on any given day, the new cases that we report on the dashboard, somewhere around like 90, 95, sometimes close to 100% of those have been swabbed or collected within the past week, 7 days. So that's a big improvement. All the testing that the National Guard is doing, they're actually running more test sites outside of New Orleans than they are here, but they're still doing, they're doing the Ilario Center, they were doing the convention center, they're still doing some other testing sites. Most of those tests were getting back in either 3 or 4 days. And every day more of these rapid tests become available. And that's going to be the new thing, is these rapid point-of-care antigen tests that are being distributed now. They're going to be more ubiquitous, and those are right away. So we're actually doing pretty good on that. The total tested volume of the state right now, you know, we took a dip with the storms, but now we're about on par about where we were the third week of August. We're consistently one of the best states in terms of testing. We were fortunate in that we weren't fortunate to have a big spike in March and April, but because we were one of the earlier states to have a spike, we got a lot of resources, and those have continued. So in this regard, we've been happy with our partnership with the feds. They've continued to given us a good supply of tests, and particularly because of the National Guard, we've been able to deploy those pretty widespread. So we feel good about it.
Any concerns? I know that they said that reagent is again going to be short in supply as we head into this flu season, you know, and that supply chain is something that may get a little bit disrupted, and obviously it'll be a challenge.
Yeah, we're concerned about that now. At the moment, we're doing okay with reagent. And one of the things that makes us more optimistic is that the testing supply is really diversified. I mean, there's just every week there's a new testing platform coming available. So the supply chain diversifies and gets more redundant on that. And the antigen tests coming down, those do not rely on the type of reagents that we're going to be using for flu tests. And we're expecting to get a lot more of those in. So, you know, I think we'll be okay with that. And in terms of flu season in general, you know, if people continue to do the precautions for COVID, that's going to be protective for flu season as well. That has been the experience in the Southern Hemisphere to date. They've had minimal flu outbreaks compared to years prior. And I really hope we see that here. And I think we will if people continue doing what they're doing.
Yeah, Dr. Fauci said the other day that we could anticipate wearing masks through the entirety of 2021.
Yeah, I know no one wants to hear that, you know, I think he's being somewhat honest. I would bet it would be sooner than that. I mean, I think it's realistic to think that we'll have widespread vaccine available for the general public mid-2021, and then once we have a good base of that, I think we can discuss, you know, when it's safe to load up on the masks. I would be shocked if we were still wearing them late into 2021, but you know, I've also been shocked a lot during these past 6 months. So.
This has been very dynamic, to say the least. Let's go to David on line one. David has a question for you. David, well, you're on with Dr. Joe Cantor.
Yes, doctor. I have a question. I've heard on television that individuals that have type O blood are less likely to catch the virus. But is that 25% less, 50% less? Or you have any numbers on that?
Hey, David, that's a great question. It comes up a lot. It's you know, what they've done is they've taken large samples of people that have COVID, and they've estimated that they've seen less numbers of people with type O blood included in that. Now, what that does not automatically mean is it doesn't automatically mean that if you have type O blood, you're less likely to get it, because there could be other confounding variables that we haven't figured out yet. I've not seen a good number to say what percentage. The other thing is, if you do have type O blood, you know, no one that's serious is going to tell you you can let up on the precautions just because you have type O blood. So I think it's an interesting thing. There's a real hope that if the relationship is real, if there really is some protection, that scientists can understand what that protection is in hopes of making it into a therapy, you know, figuring out what genetic or molecular process is allowing for that and using it as a therapy or a preventative measure for other people. What you can't do right now is say, well, I've got type O blood, so, you know, screw the mask or something like that.
Yeah. But it was, you and I have talked about this before, it was statistically significant enough to go to that next level that you just described.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's one of the more interesting data points that are out there. And I've not yet seen any good explanation about why that is, you know, why they're seeing that. We've seen the same type of thing with some other diseases. But, you know, there's probably a lot about genetic susceptibility to COVID that we don't yet understand.
It's kind of the same thing that where you have spouses, one gets it, the other one doesn't.
Yeah, and
no one could seem to explain that one away either.
Yeah,
I have a theory, but I can't really discuss that on air.
yeah, that's for after hours. We've seen the same thing with kids. You know, family has a couple of kids, both in school, similar age. One gets it, one doesn't. So we really, really don't know why, and I hope we figure that one out.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those other things that just really confounds not only the, you know, the medical community, but everybody else when you think about it.
Yeah, this is a learning process, no question about that.
Absolutely. All right, we got to get to a break. We'll be right back with Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana. Stay with us. Give us a shout, 504-260-1870 on the Mortgage Financial phone and text line. We're back, and we're talking to Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana. Doc, I wanted to dig a little deeper into this because I think it's going to really change the dialogue and the rhetoric around this testing issue because of the vast differences in states' approaches. You mentioned earlier that the state of Louisiana has been a lot more aggressive in testing, and I mentioned that a lot of other states have not been, and, you know, people are asking why. But as we reduce our positivity rate across the state, and in particular, you mentioned, you know, the Orleans Parish, Jefferson Parish, and others, does testing become more difficult to kind of extrapolate the data to kind of get a feel or an understanding as to where you are in the community as it relates to the infection rate?
Well, you know, in general, the more widespread testing is, the more confident you are that you know the size or the amount of your community spread. You know, we got really nervous during the storms a few weeks ago because testing around the state really went down, and we knew we had a lot of risk, and there was, you know, 12,000 displaced individuals from Lake Charles, and we felt like we were flying blind because we had no testing. When you do widespread testing and you have a low percent positivity rate, so let's say, you know, New Orleans, you know, per capita is doing a lot of testing and has a percent positivity rate of 1.5% in the city proper, you can be really confident that that's an accurate representation, that there's not a ton of community spread, at least not what we had prior. So the more testing you do, the more confidence you gain. Also, and this relates a little bit to, you know, parishes that want to open up bars, you know, they have to have below 5% positivity now by the governor's order for a couple of weeks to do that. You're never going to get to that percent positivity unless a parish expands the amount of testing that's performed. Because when you don't have easily available testing, then only the people who are symptomatic or who have a real reason to get tested, and that drives up your percent positivity rate. So for a parish that wanted to lower their percent positivity rate, you know, aside from following the mitigation measures, expanding testing generally helps that.
And as we continue to monitor that, you pointed out that the new rapid antigen tests that are now coming, you know, to market, which are substantially cheaper than the PCR, which I think you've referred to as really being the gold standard of tests. I understand those tests are somewhere between $50 and $100 a piece, and these others are much cheaper. Is that going to really be the protocol that everyone wants to move to sooner rather than later, is to use that cheaper alternative, the antigen test, in order to, you know, to measure where we are?
Well, I think it's going to be a combination of the two types of tests. The antigen test has pros and cons. And the pros are that it's much, much quicker. It's more accessible. You can do it point of care. You don't need a big apparatus. And some of them are just cards. Some are small handheld machines. And it's cheap. For example, the one that Abbott produces, which is right now the federal government has bought up the entire supply of, they price that at $5 a pop. So really cheap, really accessible. The downsides are that it's not as sensitive. So it's probably appropriate for screening populations. If someone is symptomatic or particularly high risk for some other reason, at this point with the data we have, we still think it needs to be followed up and confirmed with a gold standard, with a PCR test. So in high risk settings, it can give you information earlier, but it's not going to be definitive. Now, as time goes on with these tests and we get more information about how they perform, that recommendation might go away. I really hope it does. But at this point, because they're so new, nobody wants to miss a test, particularly in someone that would be in a high-risk congregate setting, be able to spread it to somebody else.
Do y'all have an idea of as it relates to the daily testing that's being done? Like today, we reported 12,850 tests. Of how many of those actually folks were symptomatic as opposed to asymptomatic?
I don't have the exact number. I mean, in general, a real minority of those are symptomatic. You know, in addition to recommending people get tested when they have symptoms, we recommend anyone that had an exposure get tested, which is a lot of people. And then you have general screening that's happening on college campuses. And then you have routine testing in hospitals for anyone that gets admitted, anyone that's going in for a procedure. But in general, the people that have symptoms are a minority of the folks that get tested. And as you expand testing, they become an even smaller minority.
Yeah, I found it interesting when you say that. Actually, I said it wrong. It's the converse of what I said. But actually, the more testing you do, the more likely your positivity rate's going to go down.
Yeah, the more likely it goes down and the more confidence you have in that number. So it really is a win-win for parishes. I never really understand why some people are resistant to doing more testing, because it really only helps in this scenario.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they're sitting down long enough to actually study and examine the information that's available out there.
Yeah.
And they're kind of reacting to sound bites, and that's the worst thing to do in the worst case scenario. Doc, as always, thank you so much. I know you are incredibly busy, but our listening audience truly appreciates the hour that you spend with us, and we do as well.
It's all my pleasure. Have a good rest of the day.
You too. Dr. Joe Kanner, Assistant State Health Officer. We'll be right back. And on a text line, they said a lot of sound bites are coming from the president. I don't disagree. I think, you know, that sometimes we are haphazardly making comments that are leading folks down one path or the other. And it's done at all levels. When you read about these, what's going on as much as I do, mostly at the local level, and it's why I like to go read local newspapers around the country to kind of get the flavor of what's going on there, it is mind-boggling what people are actually saying. And it's evident that they're not digesting any of the information and synthesizing same before they go out there as the talking head in engaging in soundbite politics. And they're following people instead of being leaders day in and day out. I bet a lot of people were surprised to hear to say that the positivity rate, the likelihood of that happening, goes up with more testing. The more we test, maybe the quicker we can open this economy. We'll be right back after the break, folks. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.